Welcome to Many Happy Miles, a podcast that celebrates all types of forward movement, whether it's a single leg deadlift, which is really hard, or a tempo run on a spring day, which is also really hard. We're here to say yay to all of it. I'm Dimity McDowell, co-founder of Another Mother Runner.
And I'm Sarah Wessner Flynn. And ouch, just that all that hard work, it's making me tired just thinking about it. But that's this nice spring day. I'm going to have to head out for my own tempo run. This Boston Marathon is right around the corner. So yeah, you just got me in the mood to go out and run. But what am I saying yay to? I'm saying yay to coming back. I'm a week back now from the national championships for my indoor track team. I wanted to just circle back because the last time we were on air, Dimity, I was about to leave for Boston. So I'm back.
Yes, I remember. Yep. And was it a successful, was this one a successful trip to Boston?
It was a very successful trip to Boston. Yes. We had some really, really amazing results. I will just one little snippet. One of my, we had one relay that set a national record. Another one, this is number two for the season. The 4x4 boys team ran 3:11, which is an average of like 48 seconds per leg. Which go out and hit your track
congrats.
And try to see how fast you can run the 400. It's not 47 seconds for most of us.
Definitely not.
One of my athletes who has been, I've been coaching since freshman year, just set the junior class national record in the 800 meters. So he ran 1:49, which was exciting. So that's the fastest anyone has ever run as a junior in high school in the indoor 800 meters for boys.
Wow.
Which is crazy. And then our superstar 400 runner set the national record in the 400 and also the world under 18 record. He ran 45 seconds for the 400.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That's like watching the Olympics,
it
right?
Is.
I mean, they just,
yes.
It's so fast.
It is.
Well, congratulations. Mm-hmm. That is so cool. To have those kind of results under your guidance is so fun to hear about.
It's a lot of fun, yeah. I'm looking forward to outdoor, which starts next week. So, well, we've already started practice. Outdoor track meet. Will be our first outdoor track meet next week. So no rest here. But
I was about to say, no rest to Boston. Let's go.
Yeah. So, yeah, tell me what's going on in your world.
Yeah. So I'm taking it a little bit easier out here in Denver. Definitely not running on the track or training for Boston. But I did get to meet this amazing woman yesterday named Rachel. And I just wanted to drop a line because she is a fierce podcast listener. She really loves the AMR podcast. And the coolest part of her is that she's really young. Mm-hmm. She is a senior at Northeastern University right now in Boston. And she just loves that we come in and talk about regular things. We're not talking about peak performance. I mean, certainly we talk sometimes about peak performance, but just keep it real, keep it coming from the middle of the pack. And she was just a delight to talk to. We had a little coffee meeting. And I mean, such a go-getter. She ran track in high school, had some injuries, so doesn't run for the school in college, but she's likes to do half marathons on her own. And she started this sustainable food company called Rooted Living when she was 19. And it's this delicious granola in compostable packaging. She's doing her senior thesis on the sustainable business of food. I'm just like,
wow.
I just got tired just like listening to her. Yeah. Because I'm like, so what are you going to do after you graduate? And she's like, well, run my business and I want to get my yoga teacher training. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I stand in awe. So
yeah,
first of all, Rachel, thank you for listening. Mm-hmm. And secondly, you know, I would love to, we're going to put Rooted Living, the granola in our Sunday rest day newsletter. So you can check it out if you want to. It's like I said, it's delicious and all ingredients you can pronounce and I love the energy of people like that who are just like, okay, you know what? Show me that I can't get it done and I'm going to get it all done.
Mm-hmm.
And she does it with a lot of grace and style.
Very cool. I have to check out that granola.
Okay, switching topics to a woman who is equally as energetic and knowledgeable. We are going to talk to Danielle Friedman today. Danielle is a journalist in New York and the author of Let's Get Physical, How Women Discovered Exercise and Reshaped the World. She's also a return guest. She was on the Friday podcast, I think, to talk about her book. Danielle, when did your book come out?
In January 2022.
Okay, so it's been a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. It was a great book. Well, today she's also here to talk about a piece of writing that she did. It was for the New York Times, and she talked to top experts to debunk 8 fitness myths that are very common. So we're super excited. We're going to kind of walk through each of them. So welcome, Danielle.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Danielle, again, thank you so much for joining us. And before we get into the myths, tell us about yourself. Where do you live and what do you do besides write for the New York Times, which, hello, dream job.
Thank you. Well, I am a health journalist. I live in Manhattan. I live on the Upper East Side. I'm a mom to a almost 15-month-old and 5.5-year-old. So we have a very, it's 2 boys. It's a very noisy, but joyful household. And for me, my work and my personal interests, there's a lot of overlap. Part of why I wrote Let's Get Physical and what led me to the work that I'm doing now, contributing to the Well section, is my love of movement. I'm a lifelong runner. I'm a slow runner, and in recent years, I've become a more proud slow runner. I wrote about my turtle-like pace for the Times, but it's really core to my identity. And I'm engaged in a lot of other movement practices too.
Yeah. What else do you like to do besides running, Danielle?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I will say my work for the Times, this has happened several times where I've been assigned to report a story, or I've been curious about something, and then my reporting actually leads me to start doing it. So this happened with Pilates. I sort of did a fact check on whether Pilates was as good as people said it was, and it turns out it is if you go to the right studio. So I did prenatal and then postpartum Pilates, and now I've continued doing it a year out. And I started recently going to a weight training gym. I was, doing so much writing about the benefits of strength training. And while Pilates is a strength training workout, I really felt like I needed to lift a little bit heavier. And so I've really enjoyed that. I mean, there is something, it's literally empowering, to be using your muscles in that way. And I've done researching the history of bar is what actually led me to my book, by learning about the founder of bar in the 1950s. I've dabbled. I've done a little bit of everything.
Yeah, it sounds great. You try it all, which is great. So we want to get into this story that you wrote a few months ago, and you call it anecdote and gym lore. And I think that a lot of that has been spread by social media influencers, et cetera. There's just a lot of information out there that may or may not be true about exercise, working out, and staying healthy. So you broke it up into 8 parts. And so we're going to try to get into them all. But first, we want to have a bit of a disclaimer. So Danielle, while your piece is backed by top researchers, as we know, there's always 2 sides to every argument. And our listener out there, you may not agree with everything that we discussed today. But just so everybody knows, this is just meant to be a lively discussion versus us telling you what's right or wrong. Mm-hmm. So on that note, let's get started. All right. So myth 1. Now, this one is a favorite of mine because I was taught to do this in high school. But you're saying we should not stretch before we work out. And I do agree with that. But I think in high school, we were all taught to make sure we stretch before we work out. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was just sort of part and parcel of exercising. You had to stretch before you started moving, with the idea that you were kind of limbering your body up. But it turns out that when we static stretch, so when we hold a stretch, particularly for 90 seconds or more before exercising, we're actually temporarily weakening the muscle that we're stretching. So, if you think about it, I mean, you obviously don't want to be weakening your muscles before you need to use them. So experts recommend instead doing a dynamic warm-up. Dynamic warm-ups have really caught on in the past few years, but stretches where you're also moving and contracting the muscle, like squats or lunges, there's a whole host of exercises you could do. And then static stretching is best done basically removed from exercise. So one of the experts I spoke to suggested doing it before bed, so you give your muscles some time to recover.
Is it okay to stretch? I mean, after a workout, does that have the same? I mean, if you're going to do that, you mentioned 90 seconds, which is a very long time to hold a stretch. I've been. I've been doing that for some physical therapy stuff that I'm needing to do. I'm like, I have to watch the clock because you're like, am I done? You're like, no, you're 45 seconds in, Dimity. You got halfway to go.
I know.
But is it okay to okay again, meaning like, is it more beneficial if you're not going to be able to stretch maybe before bed, if that's not going to be in your routine, is it okay to go after a workout, like to do it at the tail end?
My understanding is it's less harmful to do it after than to do it before. You know, everyone I spoke to did suggest creating a little bit of distance between, you know, a moderate to high intensity workout and stretching.
Okay.
But again, if you're going to do it, it's better to do it after than before.
Okay. Good to know. All right. Second one. And this one, I mean, I think we have to kind of unpack because you brought it up in the intro. We just had Stacey Sims on the Friday podcast. So it's trending. I mean, the myth is that you need to lift heavy to build muscle. Yeah. So tell us, what do you think about that? What did you find about that? I mean, this is a hard one.
Yeah. And I know as I was mentioning my new weight training regimen a few moments ago, I was thinking about this myth. And for me, it just so happens the gym that I've been going to specializes in, you know, lifting heavy weights, but
yeah,
there are many ways to do it. And so there is this, I think, cultural perception that to really build muscle, you have to lift a heavy load, but new research is showing that that's just not true. And so doing, you know, for example, 30 reps of a lighter weight can be just as effective at building lean muscle mass as 5 to 12 reps of a much heavier weight. It's really just a matter of what you prefer. You know, some people find the heavier weights more efficient because there's fewer reps involved. And for others, they're just really intimidating or they don't have access to them. So yeah, that's good news for people who find lifting lighter weights more accessible.
Yeah. So I have a question for you. Do you know if like the study or the person that you talked to, who they were talking to, because I will say, I feel like the shift for heavy lifting definitely is focused on women kind of in, you know, perimenopause, menopause, you know, kind of as we start to age and really lose muscle mass.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're wondering who was included in the study or studies?
Yeah. Like, yeah. Or who the researcher was.
Yeah. His name is Brad Schoenfeld and he specializes in studying muscle growth. He's an exercise scientist. And I mean, I think this was just the expert I spoke with that I quoted in the story, but this was a finding that was repeated in conversations with the other exercise scientists and sports medicine physicians that I interviewed.
Sure.
Now, one thing that was interesting to me that I didn't actually include in the piece is, and it goes without saying, but if your goal is to lift really heavy weights, like you want to be able to power lift or you have daily activities that require lifting really heavy things, lifting heavier weights is going to help you. You can't lift heavier by lifting, you know, light weights, if that makes sense. But for daily life, for the lean muscle mass that's so beneficial to us as we get older, lifting light weights at, you know, higher reps is great.
That's cool. I think that's so important. I mean, again, like there are so many ways to skin a cat. So I don't want to discredit the podcast that Stacey Sims did at all. I mean, because what she talked about was very effective and that's also research backed. But I think what happens sometimes with heavy lifting, the idea of heavy lifting is, you said it, Danielle, it's intimidating, right? And I know most of our listeners are endurance athletes, right? Like, we like to get those endorphins flowing. We like to run. We like to cycle. We like to hike, you know? And so strength training is always kind of a PS on it anyway. And then if you say, and you have to lift heavy, you know, so that means, you know, again, like many people, including myself, until about less than a year ago, I didn't know how to deadlift properly. I didn't know how to squat with a barbell properly. Bench press is a little bit easier because you're lying down. There's definitely this, like, there's a learning curve there. And I feel like if it's already kind of your number two exercise and you're like, but you got to go and you got to, you know, make sure that you only can, you know, can push out 6 reps max and then you've got to wait in between. And I get it. I understand that. That's optimal, again, but there's so many ways that you can still benefit from strength training. And again, if you have, you know, 5 pound weights, if you just have your body, like those are not, that doesn't mean like you get to get off the hook from doing it. You know,
exactly.
I guess that's kind of what I want to, yeah. I mean, that's my biggest beef with the heavy lifting. I agree with it 100% and I do it too. And I really enjoy it. Like you said, it is very empowering and it's fun to kind of learn a new skill in your athletic quiver, so to speak, but it is, you know, I definitely feel like it can also be like, okay, well, if I can't do the exact right thing, then I'm not going to do it. And that's exactly what I feel like can be the negative side of that.
Yeah, 100%. I think with so many kind of movement practices, we tend to take an all or nothing approach. You know, it's like, well, I don't have time to go for a 30-minute run, so I'm just going to do nothing. And with strength training, you know, that's certainly, as we know, with everything, any movement is better than none. And in this case, again, lifting lighter weights or doing resistance exercises can, in some cases, you know, be as beneficial as lifting heavy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for what it's worth, I mean, we do burpees at that place and those are always going to be one of the hardest exercises ever. And you don't need any weights at all. So
I about maybe a year and a half ago, I wrote a story for the Times about, you know, like it was like, I think it was called a low pressure guide to finally forming a strength training habit or something like that. And, one of my tips was basically that you can use your couch for a strength training workout. If you really can't get off the couch, you can turn it into a gym basically and do resistance exercises while you watch TV or watch your kids. So there are lots of different ways, like you said.
Agreed. Okay. Well, let's move to myth 3. This one is also a kind of hot button. It's running destroys your knees. To put a finer point on it, you have the quote of our knees are like tires. You drive the car a lot and you burn through the tire tread. But this has been debunked. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, there is this, again, there's this cultural fallacy that in the long run, no pun intended, running is, you know, running will wreck your knees. And I think people who don't run will often admonish runners that they're actually harming themselves. And even among medical professionals, this idea, you know, has been and in some parts is still somewhat prevalent. But the latest research really does debunk that. And in fact, what we know is that being sedentary and a lack of movement puts you at greater risk for osteoarthritis than running. So don't use the, I do not like the word excuse, but the fear, I should say, that you're going to damage your knees in the long run as a reason not to run. At the same time, and I'm someone who I've suffered knee injuries here and there, this is not to say that running can't harm your knees at all. You know, it can obviously make you susceptible to some injuries if you're not careful, if you run too fast, too far, too soon. But that's different than actually doing that kind of long-term damage that so many people fear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have a question for you, and this may be off the scope of your article, but my take is that on running, like, it doesn't hurt your knees, but if your body is imbalanced, like your hips are not aligned or your knee, like you have a leg discrepancy or something like that, it exacerbates that. Have you ever talked to anyone that said that or your own gut? I mean, that's where I feel like a lot of the injuries come from.
Yeah. And I think this is more anecdotal, although it's kind of a thread that runs through a lot of my conversations. But yes, imbalances, lack of strength, which actually I think we're going to probably get to in a moment or two.
Yeah.
You know, if you're weak in one muscle group, you're probably compensating somewhere else, and that can lead to imbalances, which can then lead to injury. And I think when we do try to run too far, too fast, too soon, or even just too far, too fast on their own too soon, those imbalances can be triggered and so, or can lead to injury more sort of quickly. So yeah, it's really important to be mindful of, you know, your weak spots and to address them.
Do those side planks.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, so on that like spectrum of running, a lot of us, including myself, have turned to walking more because I've just had accumulation of running injuries, Danielle, that just does not allow me to run pain-free anymore. Mm. So that's okay. I'm accepting that. I'm moving on as best I can. As much grace as I can give myself. So I walk a lot. And the myth here is walking is enough to keep you fit as you age. Can you talk about that?
Yeah.
I think it's good socially for sure, right?
Yes. And I love that walking has had this kind of golden, we're in this golden era of walking since the pandemic, you know, since it began and people discovered the joy of just moving for the sake of moving and getting outdoors. And I'm always very reluctant to say anything that could be interpreted as discouraging of whatever type of movement you love. So walking is great. However, as we get older, it's basically not enough to help protect you from some of the most common injuries that can really impact your independence. So I spoke with Anne Brady, who's an associate professor of exercise science at UNC Greensboro. And she works with a lot of older clients. And, she was basically saying that as we get older, we really just need kind of a minimal amount of cardiovascular strength or health to be able to complete our daily activities. But if you don't have the muscular strength, the power to do daily activities, that's when your quality of life can really begin to suffer. So the advice here is to keep walking, but if you can, to also do at least 2 20-minute sessions of strength training a week.
Yep. That seems totally doable.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It does. Mm-hmm. And does balance come in there too, Danielle? Again, I'm kind of like pushing you beyond probably what you had word count for, but I'm just curious.
Yeah. Well, it's all interconnected, you know, strength, balance, mobility, flexibility. So, of course, if you wanted to, you know, take more safeguards, if you wanted to really shore your body up against injury, or even put your body in a position where if you do get injured, you can recover and resume daily activities, incorporating stretching, not before exercise, but stretching and some of this and balance work can help. And the strength training will help to improve your balance.
Sure, for sure. Stay tuned. We'll be back with a couple more myths after this break.
All right. So we're going to jump to the next myth, which I think a lot of people can, you know, relate to, is that you need 10,000 steps a day to be healthy. Now, why is this a myth?
Yeah. So this number of 10,000 has really, you know, taken on this kind of magical significance in our culture. So many, if not maybe all, of the fitness trackers, the wearables, I think are kind of auto-set to 10,000 steps as a blanket goal that everybody should be striving for, when actually that number is really arbitrary. And it traces back to the 1960s when a Japanese clock manufacturer mass-produced this pedometer with a name that translated to 10,000 steps meter. And then it just became ingrained in our idea of, you know, it's a nice round number, a number of steps we should be striving for. Research has shown that actually the health benefits of walking tend to more or less plateau at around 7,500 steps, give or take. But taking as few as 4,000 steps a day can significantly, you know, reduce your risk of premature death from any cause. And the experts that I spoke with were really, they were irked by this 10,000 steps goal because they had encountered a lot of people who felt like that number was way out of reach for them. And so then, like I was saying before, you know, they just kind of threw in the towel and moved very little. So it's important. I mean, it's motivating, I think, for a lot of people. But it's certainly not essential to your health to hit that number.
Right. And like I said, I think we can all relate to that as runners or people who just move. Like some days I have a lot of steps and sometimes I don't have that many at all. You know,
it's like absolutely
everything. And, you know, it doesn't have to be this magic number. I find it so fascinating that this kind of stem from a watchmaker
back
in the 1960s. I always wondered about that. Like, where did this come from? Where did this idea of this magic number of 10,000 come from? fact that it's persisted since the 1960s is so interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I love that it's a range here. Again, it's not black and white. It's 4,000 to like 7,500. Because, I mean, even so, yeah. I mean, again, as I'm a walker more now than a runner, it's hard to get to 10,000.
It really
is. I mean, you have to commit yourself, you know, like, because that's more or less 5 miles, right? About 2,000 steps is about a mile. Correct. Yeah. So, I mean, 5 miles walking, like that is, you know, that's like an hour, 40 minutes. It can be, you know, I mean, it's not an insignificant amount of time. So I feel like, yeah, I like that idea. I mean, I like the fitness trackers. I think that they're helpful for people, but again, like, it's like, if it's not, if you can't get to 10,000, then you've lost. I think that sucks, right? That's
not a fail.
Yeah, it's not a fail. Not a fail. Exactly.
For me, it was very liberating to like go in and adjust the, you know, the ring benchmarks on my Apple Watch, which it took me a few years to do and to accept that kind of like those were just suggestions, you know, they're not right for everybody. And and I feel so much better about just my fitness having tailored them to my specific needs and level. And even in New York City, I mean, I feel like there are days when I'm walking, I'm moving all day long, and I'll look at my watch and it's like 6,000 steps. And so it's not easy, but again, I think the more you can meet yourself where you are, the better.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. The next one I think is good for a little ego check. Modifications are for beginners. I know I just led a strength training class about an hour ago in our many happy miles, and we were doing side planks on our knees, right? And that is kind of the beginner phase of side planks, but they're still very hard. They can be, you know, so talk a little bit. I mean, I think sometimes we think like when an instructor like is like, okay, you can do this or you can do B, which is ups the challenge. And we all want to go to B because we all want to be the striver and the, you know, the better athlete. But why are modifications not just for beginners?
Yeah, well, I mean, with so many of the exercises where modifications are an option or are recommended, you know, full body resistance exercises like push-ups or planks, form is so important. And many of these exercises too require a significant amount of strength, you know, strength that some people might be born with or might have when they're younger, but that for many of us requires training. And so you're going to benefit so much more by, like I was saying a moment ago, you know, modifying to meet your body where it is and mastering the form and gradually building that strength than you would be by attempting to do the full out exercise and then overcompensate, you know, with a different muscle group and maybe even injure yourself. So this was something that came up with several people that I interviewed, and it can be really hard, especially in a, you know, in a class setting, in a group setting, there is that social pressure, but you have to focus on yourself and your own body, and everyone is bringing their own, you know, experience to the class. And so there's no shame, and it doesn't necessarily mean you're a beginner either. It's just what's right for you on that day or in that season of your life.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been, you know, an athlete, quote unquote, since I can remember. I still modify. There's definitely things that I know I cannot do or I can do better, like you said, with form. Mm-hmm. For example, push-ups. Like, gosh darn it, do I want to do a real push-up? But like, I'm like, when I'm demonstrating them to my athletes or whatever, because I'm a coach, like, I'll just do them from my knees because I know that's like my best form. Yeah. And I just give myself grace for that. I'm like, I'm still getting in the strength work. Not to the maximal potential, but like still like it's okay. You can modify. And I think that applies to strength exercises. It also applies to, you know, Dimity and I talk a lot about like, you know, giving yourself grace, run walking, for example. We have a lot of listeners who run walk or, you know, just do modifications and to not feel bad because you're not doing it to like the extreme, right?
Absolutely.
Everything in moderation. Yes. I think that's the theme for this, you know, this section for sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we've been talking about strength training, and I think this myth, most of our listeners would 100% agree with debunking, is that you don't need strength training as a runner or a cyclist. Specifically, you don't need to strength train your lower body as a runner and cyclist, but that is incorrect. So tell us why.
Yeah. So, you know, running, cycling obviously builds some lower body strength, but the activities are not enough to stimulate significant muscle growth. And so, like we were talking about before, when you lack the strength in, you know, various particularly lower body muscle groups, other muscles will compensate, will overcompensate, and you're more prone to injury. So including lower body strength training exercises that can complement whatever activity you're doing, so squats, lunges, glute bridges, pointers, will not only help to lower your risk of injury, but make you a stronger runner or cyclist.
Yeah. Is that, did you talk at all about when, like if I'm going to go do a hard run or a long bike ride, the strength training, should that be done in like congruently with that, like on the same day? Or is it better to let your legs have a break and then hit the strength training? Do you have any insight on that?
So that didn't come up specifically in this conversation, but based on what I know, I would definitely recommend doing them on alternate days because if you do the strength, I mean, you know, depending on your, again, your level of fitness and experience, you could combine them, but giving your muscles some time to rest and recover, I think will help form both for the strength training exercises and for the aerobic activity. So I think you're probably better off separating them by a day.
Love it. I love it. All right. And so then let's hit one recovery one, which again is super trendy. Everyone's lowering themselves into their, you know, their ice baths, their, what is it called? Hydrotherapy?
Cryo.
Lunch.
Cryotherapy.
Cryo. Yeah.
I knew it had something to do with that. It's something with an O in therapy. Okay. So the myth, the final myth, Danielle, that you put in this article was taking an ice bath after a tough workout improves recovery. And I think people would be surprised that there is little research behind that, huh?
Yeah. So the sports medicine physician who was really passionate about this one was explaining that, as you know, as listeners might know, when you exercise, when you work your muscles, you're producing inflammation, but not all inflammation is bad inflammation. When you're talking about building strength and muscle growth, the inflammation that happens triggers, you know, a healing response, a repair process that then builds strength. So if you jump into an ice bath after every workout, you're actually slowing or stunting that repair process and, you know, working against your goal of building strength. So what he recommended instead was either icing, if you have an injury, icing the specific injury. Saunas are better for overall recovery, heat as opposed to ice. But not using ice baths as this kind of like part of your routine after every workout.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. And does it make sense after certain ones? Like I know like people enjoy, I'm putting that in quotation marks, like after a marathon, right? Like when you've done like a really significant effort, or I know like after a hike, sometimes I like to submerge myself in a nearby stream. Is that helpful every once in a while? Or do you know about that?
I think if I could kind of channel what the experts I spoke with said, it would be more like, it's not harmful, you know, to do it every once in a while. And this particular physician I interviewed was one of the team physicians for the UCLA Bruins football team. Mm-hmm. And so he was saying that, like, you know, his football players who get really beat up will often take ice baths after games. And in that case, it is beneficial because their bodies have taken a beating. But as just as this sort of part of your wellness routine after a regular workout, it's not going to do you any favors. He did say if you really like the feeling, you know, you could wait 24 hours because then you've given your body time to start the repair process. But I'm sure every once in a while is not going to hurt. It's just it's just doing it as a matter of course.
Yeah. When I travel with my team for track meets, we make sure that they do take ice baths in between. If it's a 2 or 3 day meet and they have to compete the very next day, that's where like it's very essential, I think, for that routine to come into play. But then, for the average runner, for somebody, you know, who doesn't have competitions back to back to back, you know,
right?
I guess you say it could be a little bit of overkill. which might be good news for people who, like me, who hate the cold water.
Yeah.
It feels like torture when I do it, but like, oh, it's a necessary evil sometimes. But yeah.
Yeah. And I think it really depends on kind of what your goal is. So like with competition, if you just want, you know, you're not looking to necessarily build muscle growth or, you know, become stronger during a meet. You just, you know, you want to perform. And so I think for performance, it could be valuable, but as a long-term strategy, less so.
Yeah. Right.
Awesome.
Danielle, that was awesome. You got through eight. Now there might be some people out there like tisking or shaking their head. So I was wondering, like, from the comments or from just, you know, feedback that you got once this hit the times, was there one myth or one or two myths that got more pushback or more controversial than others?
That is such a great question. I mean, the story generated a very lively discussion in the comments. There were like 815 comments.
So did you have any comments that people were like, absolutely not, or I've been doing this my whole life, or was there anything like that?
I mean, I think there was some pushback on the running destroys your knees because people would share their personal experiences about, you know, situations where they did experience long-term injuries or issues and weren't able to run. But overall, I think the response was positive.
It was.
Yeah. So you're never going to please everybody.
Exactly. And again, people tend to feel very strongly about their own personal experiences with these issues and try to take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah. Well, thank you for doing the work that you do and keep putting out these stories that trigger lively conversations and inform us all about our own health and wellness in a very well-written and factual way. You're such a great writer and we love reading your work. So thank you for coming on and sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
All right, friends, join us for Go the Distance, our first ever endurance event. It's happening April 20th and 21st, and it's a celebration of community, forward movement, and stepping outside of your comfort zone. You make all the choices. You choose the activity. You can run, you can walk, you can join our Peloton posse that is going to be doing classes all day long. You can row, you can hike, whatever you like to do. You pick the distance as well. It can be in miles, it can be in time, it could be a loop around your neighborhood, and the duration. You can go 6 hours, 12 hours, 24 hours. Sounds confusing. I promise it's not. It's basically you start one activity at the top of every hour on the hour, and you go for 6, 12, or 24 hours. The link is in our show notes, and we've got a special offer for longtime listeners, but first-time customers. So if you've never tried a program with us, this is a chance to come in, dip your toes, and check it out. So the links will be in the show notes, and we hope to have you go the distance with us. Our podcast today was produced by Barry Medore of Fire on the Bluff in St. Paul, Minnesota.